And I want to try to cover quite a little bit today. I'm going to continue with some alternative to incarceration or alternative punishments, whatever you'd like to call them. And then I want to deal a little bit with how the gospel speaks to us and what I've been dealing with all week long. And it strictly will be based right on biblically. I'll just take it out of the Bible, and that's what I will do with it. So I would especially appreciate it if you have questions and so forth, if you'll hold them until I'm through, and then I'll be glad to go into some detail. I dealt yesterday with a little bit with restitution. Today, one of the alternatives, community service orders. Now, these are merely suggestions and ideas that have been discussed and utilized in some areas, some successfully, some marginal. Any program that we try to put together to alleviate our prison population, our system, and is always a struggle. And it's a trial and error thing. It's really greatly dependent on the how interested society is in making it work. A criminal act is an offense against particular victims, of course, but it is also an offense against society. Both suffer loss. An individual is violated and public safety is diminished. The offender is thereby said to incur a debt to society. But as long as punishment and imprisonment are considered synonymous, neither the victim nor society is compensated. To the contrary, both then incur the additional heavy cost of imprisonment. We've discussed restitution by offenders to their individual victims. Is there a comparable approach to compensating society? Too often, offenders now pay their debt to society in prison. The resulting waste of valuable human resource is easy to document. For instance, the prisoner operating the washing machine next to Charles Colson at Maxwell Federal Prison had been a prominent doctor convicted of stock fraud. There was no resident doctor in this particular prison, so the many inmates with medical needs had to rely on a paramedic with a qualified doctor, while a qualified doctor spent his days putting dirty underwear into the washing machine each morning and taking it out each afternoon. Later, he volunteered to help meet a shortage of doctors in the surrounding community by working nights, but his offer was refused. Such short-sightedness serves neither the victim, the offender, nor society. Instead of being sent to prison, offenders could be required to work for a period of years, either at a very modest pay or none at all, in ghettos, hospitals, or other areas of public need. Such alternatives need not be limited to white-collar offenders. Present community service programs provide work opportunities for skilled and unskilled workers alike. California is operating some 50 community service alternatives for offenders. Similar community service orders have been employed in England with dramatic success. That makes sense to me. Society can reap the benefits instead of paying the bill. This is kind of an interesting one. I've never heard of this one before, and I was quite, when I read it, I said, hey, it's got some possibilities, and it's kind of different. House arrest. This alternative is primarily for convicted felons whose probation reports indicate they are unlikely to be involved in further criminal behavior. Many of those sentenced to house arrest are first-time offenders with no record of prior criminal activity. In California, for example, a nurse in Berkeley was sentenced to house arrest for 1 year for the fatal shooting of her husband. Mitigating circumstances were present, and that's underlined. The alternative was approved by a committee of Alameda County officials in response to prison overcrowding and the high cost of incarceration. The convicted woman was required to report each morning and evening, 7 days a week, to the county's probation department. This sentence permitted her to maintain her nursing job and care for her child. She was not on the welfare rolls. Her child was not having to go to a foster home. She was allowed to maintain herself and still become a responsible citizen and pay back society for what's happened. Probation and contract probation. Probation is one of the most widely used alternatives. And I discussed probation in either yesterday or the day before. And quite often, generally the ones that are violated on probation are younger ones, as I mentioned, who think it's a game and think it's kind of funny, and until they hit the big time and wind up down in Shelton where we are, and then they commence to realize it's tough. Probation is one of the most widely used alternatives. Offenders on probation are sentenced to obey specific behavior guidelines under the supervision of a probation officer. Violation of the guidelines can result in incarceration. So the offender has every incentive to avoid that prospect, assuming that he's heard the message. Contract probation is usually offered as an alternative to incarceration by one of the lawyers involved. Interestingly enough, often the prosecutor's office advocates the program. The judge is presented with a program of punishment, often including community service or restitution. Under the guidelines set down, the offender reports to an authority designated by the court throughout the term of the parole. Another method whereby the community becomes involved, and it is basically, we're talking a great deal here about community-based corrections, where the something patterned after the way here some years ago in this state, and I don't know about other states, the mentally ill, because of they closed Northern State, and in an effort to help those who were not dangerous, that could be treated in the community, these people were then referred to mental health facilities in the community from which they came from, thereby the community taking some responsibility and not losing sight of, okay, this guy is in trouble, we throw him in the county jail, we ship him off to one of the prisons, and he's out of sight. We've blocked it. We've done what we're supposed to do. We're paying the prison to take care of them, and we don't have to worry about it anymore. But we forget, as I said yesterday, 98% of the people come back out of prison. A large percent of them go back to the community from which they came from. And I would assume that you would like to have them come back as good citizens, able to carry their own weight, pay their share of the bill. Right now, I don't think you're getting that. But this is, by and large, what I'm talking about when I say community-based corrections. Deferred sentencing. Offenders assigned this alternative to incarceration plead guilty to their charge and undergo a pre-sentence investigation. The presiding judge then defers sentencing for several months, during which the offender is referred to service agencies, alcohol and drug treatment, for example. If the offender's response is positive, the judge may impose a sentence of probation with a stipulation of continued participation in rehabilitative programs. Now, this is used to some degree in the state of Washington, and here again, it's back in the lap of the community. Unfortunately, most of us get a little upset if there's going to be a halfway house in our community or some form of housing or treatment of, quotes, criminals. For instance, Furlan's Correction Center in the north end of Seattle, some of you may be aware of that. It was the old Furlan's Sanitarium, and part of it now is the correction, the Burlington Correction Center and the Burkrest, which is are mentally, incapacitated people, emotionally upset and so forth. That houses those generally younger people who are first-time offenders, who have a pretty good record, and who the pre-sentence investigation and the parole board and the court feels they have a good chance of making it, of rehabilitation, of not offending again. And I've asked numerous people, what does the community feel about Furlan? Because it's surrounded by residences and communities and so forth, people that have their homes there. By and large, I've heard nothing but, no, we haven't any problem with it. And actual statistics prove that these facilities have actually enhanced the area as opposed to pulling it down. A lot of people say, well, it's going to, our property value goes down. It's never been proved that that has happened. So it's something to think about. Too often we get in thinking that we just don't want those people around us, and we send a lot of people to prison that don't need to be in prison. That's something we have to think about. Suspended sentencing. This alternative involves establishment of a fixed sentence by the presiding judge, who then suspends the sentence for a specified period of time, subject to the offender's compliance with behavioral guidelines. If the guidelines are violated, the original offense, original sentence takes effect. There's always a hooker there. I mean, there's always provisions in these various alternatives to incarceration to allow the court, if this person isn't making it, show signs of deteriorating and not following the guidelines laid down, to revoke and then commit to the institution. So that hooker is always there. Assessment of fines is already a typical penalty for many crimes, but such sentences could be more widely used in places of imprisonment, in place of imprisonment for nonviolent offenses. However, the amount of a fine should be based on both the seriousness of the offense and the offender's ability to pay. Only thus can the United States reduce the blatant discrimination which leads to incarceration of a disproportionate number of the poor, those unable either to pay fines or secure sophisticated legal representation. I'm asked quite often, why do we have so many Chicanos? Why do we have so many blacks? Why do we have so many Indians in prison? Part of it, of course, is the lack of education that a lot of them have had, the negative environment they've come from. Wherever we have failed as Christians or church people or citizens or whatever to be aware of the needs of the minorities, they get into trouble and they do not have any representation. It's a pretty well-known fact, except in very rare cases, where the public defender sees his client for maybe 15 minutes to a half an hour before he goes to court. More often than not, the public defender will recommend that the man plead guilty or that he plead bargain. I can only speak from the results of some of that type of advice. More often than not, we find, particularly in the Indians and the Chicanos, where they really don't understand what's going on. And they've been told one thing, or they understand one thing, and something else happens. And that's not an attempt to point the finger that the lawyers involved in the public defender program. It's state funded. However, the attorney gets a minimum amount of money. I'm not sure what it is. But also here again, they are overloaded, overtaxed. There's no way that they can keep up with the amount of cases they're receiving. Because by and large, the public defenders get the largest percent of cases going to court, criminal cases going to court. Because the affluent ones who have the money to fight their case, they get a good high-powered lawyer. And 9 times out of 10, they not necessarily beat the case, but they'll come off much lighter than they would have if they'd had to depend on the public defender. That's a sad commentary. The bottom line of that is, if you got money, maybe you can beat it. And that's a sad commentary. Alcohol and drug treatment. We do have in the state of Washington a number of alcohol and drug treatment programs, very good ones. Most of them are private organizations. As I mentioned previously here in one of my sessions, we had drug and alcohol programs in our prisons in the state of Washington, but due to the budget cuts, they were taken out. We don't have them anymore. So therefore, anybody sentenced to any of our institutions in this state have no possibility of drug or alcohol treatment within the institution. And it's a case of, as I also stated, there is drug trafficking within the prison, and there is a minor amount of alcohol called Pruno that they make in prison. And it's so wild, not too many of them drink it. It's pretty bad stuff. Drugs, another thing. A lot of pot, some coke, and some heroin. Gets in there very easy, and I think I discussed that. There's some attempt to sentence particularly flagrant drug offenders to the Washington drug program here in the state of Washington by the courts. And quite often, here recently, we've been able to, the parole board has taken some out rather than send them to the institution. They have redirected them to through classification to the drug offenders program, or to the drug programs. And they're having some success. It's privately operated, but not funded by the state. And they are having some success. Employment assistance. We have, in our prison system, a fantastic amount of talent. We have young men of all ages who, up to their 30s and 40s, who are talented men, engineers, or just native talent, artists, musicians, just some fine people who have gone wrong. And that talent just sits and goes to waste. It's not utilized in any way at all. And here again, I'm speaking of nonviolent crime. Beside alcohol or drug abuse, other contributing factors to much crime are poverty and unemployment. Whenever possible, alternatives to imprisonment should be found for those whose criminal behavior might be eliminated by the development of job skills. Responsibility for developing employment programs must be shared by government, the community, and the church. Crime may reflect both personal and societal failure. Yet, too often, only the convict is punished, and underlying conditions and attitudes remain unchanged. Pretrial intervention. Some jurisdiction in America provide what is called a second chance system. First offender or an unintentional lawbreaker is given counseling. If after a year his conduct is satisfactory, the indictment is expunged and his record cleared. Researchers are still debating the value of this approach, but it's worth pursuing and refining. It could be an important means of reducing the need for prison. A lot of the things that I'm discussing are in the process of being tried. Some of them, these are alternatives to think about. Why provide alternatives? Underlying all these alternative punishment programs is our conviction that they are better than incarceration, both for society and for the offender. They do not let convicts off easy, nor are they intended merely to relieve overcrowding. Too often, however, these programs are not used as true alternatives. Rather, they are tacked to a prison sentence to follow the real punishment. This creates a disparity between the intent of the programs and their application. Unfortunately, this has been a frequent outcome of reform efforts. If reform prosecutors and judges do not all concur on the intent of a given reform, its impact can easily be lost or perverted. This has happened, for instance, with such reforms as determinate sentencing, mandatory sentencing, and other measures. And we get into the sentencing structure, particularly in the state of Washington. As I stated earlier, the United States incarcerates more people for longer periods of time than any other free nation in the world. And our sentencing, we've heard over and over again in the media and so forth and from people, why don't we get tougher? Why don't we get tougher? Longer terms, longer sentences. And if you look at the record, you'll see that over the last 10 years, our incarceration time has increased from an average of about 18 months to now we're hitting it at somewhere in the neighborhood of, in this state, somewhere around about 70 to 75 months. So that we are, quotes, getting tougher. Right now, in the state of Washington, due to some interesting factors, one, the Campbell case that I've mentioned before in Everett, the fact that it's, whether we want to accept it or not, it is an election year in this state. The parole board is giving out time like it's going out of style. And we do not accomplish anything by long-term incarceration because we do not provide the tools for that person to rehabilitate himself, to turn his life around. We put him in and we lock him up. Sooner or later, they're going to get out. And they're probably going to be worse than they went in, or certainly no better. They're going to be angry. They're going to be bitter. And they're probably still not going to understand some of the factors that caused them to be involved in where they are. So consequently, they come back to your community and reoffend. Weekend sentences are another form of alternative to long incarceration, where the offender can work during the week, maintain his family, pay his bills, and then do some time on the weekends in a community-based center, county jail, or some other provision. Protection against violence. We have to protect our people. The state of Washington is entrusted with the absolute protection of its inmates. When you sentence a person to the Department of Corrections, they become wards of the state. The state then is responsible for them. Therefore, they have to protect them. And that is almost an impossible task completely to do that. To protect each one against some of those that we have who are out to get them. If you were involved with another person, a fall partner, or you had knowledge of a crime and you were also had seen it or were in a county jail and something happened there that you witnessed, or even in the prison, if you witness a beating and so forth, you pass that information on to the authorities, you are labeled a snitch and your life is in danger. And we have protective custody. We have ways and means of trying to take care of that, but custody just cannot be everywhere at once. So the state winds up with a lot of lawsuits on their hands, being sued by inmates' families, because they've been brutally beaten, and the state is, in some cases, killed. Walla Walla has a bad record. Monroe has a bad record. Fortunately, Shelton, we've had a few knifings and beatings, but we have not had any deaths from other action of other inmates. Suicide, but not death. Offenders who must be incarcerated should also be protected against the physical, psychological, or homosexual intimidation, which has always been too much a part of prison life. Men and women do not forfeit their right to life and personal safety when they are sentenced to prison. A Florida judge, Harry Fogle, put it, "We cannot treat the Constitution as a mere technicality for these men just because they are in prison, men and women." There is a provision for good time. Anybody given a minimum sentence, we'll say he gets 5 years as a minimum. Maximum, we'll say, is 10. He gets a 5 minimum. Or even a 10 minimum, which they're doing a lot of now. Off of the top of that is a third off for good behavior. That immediately comes right off the top of his time. But also that if he gets in trouble, they can tack it back on, or part of it, any portion of it they want to. Quite often we'll hear a guy will get a major write-up, and when he goes before the board will take away 3 months of his good time, or 6 months of his good time, or a year of his good time, or whatever. Now, he can't earn that back again if he straightens up and flies right, but they have that prerogative to do that, and they do it. Another incentive, which there are very few incentives in prison, but one would be increased good time credit. Inmates should have the incentive of a reduced sentence based on constructive, positive response to their imprisonment. Consistent guidelines delineating that behavior should replace a system too often based on caprice or individual bias. And here again, we get into the dynamic of so many cases, such a large caseload, that the people, that the parole board, the counselors, cannot handle them. They just go through them as fast as they can. They've got to get so many through that mill in a certain length of time, and they're human beings. They can only do so much. Another situation we have in this state is a mandatory sentence. Mandatory sentencing are flat time. In this state we have, if a man is convicted of an armed robbery or a weapon is involved, they have what they call a mandatory sentence. It's 5-year mandatory. And for the second offense, he gets a second time up, he gets a 7-year mandatory. That simply means that he must do 5 years flat out before he can get any consideration for anything. And then he doesn't have to use that gun. It just has to be happened to be on him, or I don't. What I'm saying by not using, he didn't shoot anybody or beat anybody with it. And I've seen it happen with people with cap pistols. The victim doesn't know that. I understand that. And I hear, well, it was just a cap pistol, and anyhow, or my gun wasn't even loaded. I said, yeah, but the victim didn't know that. But 5 years flat, and then they can start talking about possibly getting out. Or 7.5 years flat, and then they start talking about parole. That's a bad one. That doesn't do anything. It hasn't stopped any use of weapons that I can see, or anybody that I talk to, or any place I've ever read that has ever done anything. That's another situation that we could do away with. We have, as I mentioned before, a Habitual Criminal Act. I think that's the most heinous law that we've got in this state, and I don't know how many states have it. And I think I touched on this before. It's a law whereby a man who has been convicted of 3 offenses, or been down 3 times, or convicted 3 times, and it doesn't have to be anything very violent. It doesn't even have to be any kind of violence. If the court or the prosecuting attorney so desires, he can charge him as a habitual criminal, and they do what they call bitching him. It's called a bitch. And that means it's a life sentence. And a life sentence in this state is 13 years, 4 months before you can be considered for parole. There's cases where, unfortunately, we have in some of our areas things have taken place where people become a nuisance to the court, become a nuisance to the community, but nothing is done particularly, and they haven't done anything really violent, but they have been convicted and maybe sentenced to Shelton, and they've been to prison, and nothing has happened for them. And about the third time, they get tired of it, so they decide to charge him with the Habitual Criminal Act. And they can do that more than once. They can have 2 of those hanging on them, 2 life sentences. Which means they've got to do, if they're running what they call running wild, they run first one and then the other. And they do 13-4. And then when they get through with that one, they do another 13-4. And I don't know any way that you're going to salvage that human being. Those are some of the things that need to be looked at. And my hope and prayer for you people here who have spent this week with me is that you've heard something that will at least interest you enough to take a look at your own communities, your own church, and if nothing more, at least in maybe conversation with your friends and so forth, to talk about some of these things. Maybe take some time to go down to your county jail. Take a look at it. Talk to the people down there. They'll listen to you. They're interested. I have found over the years that I've been involved in one way or another in criminal justice, and specifically the last 2 years, that most people involved in the criminal justice system, in our prisons and our laws, are really interested in doing something besides changing some of the things that are going on besides what's happening now. None of us are talking about the do-gooder to go out there and open the gate. We're talking about humane treatment, rehabilitating the inmate, sending back to society as a employable citizen, a credit to your community. And believe me, there's many, many people in prison who have the potential of being a real credit to your community. And I'd like to share a few things with you here. How the gospel speaks to us. And I think one of the outstanding, I'll start with Hebrew 13, verse 3. Remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you also are in the body. I've had a number of people ask me, I've been up here this week, and other areas also, what's the Bible say about prisons and people in prison? And what can churches do? How can we become involved? Or should we become involved? I had a lot of questions like that. And I think, to me, the gospel speaks pretty clearly and pretty straightforward about it, where we are. And I also feel that part of our responsibility is to be good stewards of what the Bible says to us. That we approach these things with common sense, with understanding, with concern, and an effort to look before we leap. Too often we go off the deep end, I think, sometimes. First, I'm sure all of you are aware or familiar with Matthew 25, starting with verse 34. Then the king will say to those at the right hand, "Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink? And when did we see thee a stranger and welcome thee, or naked and clothe thee? And when did we see the sick or in prison and visit thee?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." And by the same token, to carry that on, Jesus also told us that where we do not reach out in concern to our brother, then we are in ignoring him also. And when I speak of this group of people, the disenfranchised, I'm speaking of victim, inmate, sick, physically ill, mentally ill. That segment of our community and our society that we intend to keep in the closet. And it is time we have to look at. Sometimes we lock up the sick too. John 8 speaks, verse 7. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone. In Romans 3, verse 23 and 24. Since all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, they are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as an expiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to prove at the present time that he himself is righteous, that he justifies him who has faith in Jesus. And the last, Romans 13, 19 through 21. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. No, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For by so doing you will heap burning coals upon his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And I think for me, probably the thing that I think speaks very clearly is Luther's theology of the cross. And in part, frequently in the scriptures, there are two opposite ideas side by side. For example, judgment and righteousness, wrath and grace, death and life, evil and good. This is what is referred to in the phrase, these are the great works of the Lord. An alien work is done by him so that he might effect his proper work. Isaiah 28, 21. For in a wonderful way, he makes the conscience glad, as it is expressed in Psalms 4, 1. In tribulation, you have made me greater. That means you have made more of me, improved me. Now this is what infusion of grace means. As it says in Romans 5, 4, experience works hope, and hope makes us not ashamed. Here we find the theology of the cross, or as the apostles express it, the word of the cross is a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentile. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 and 23, because it is utterly hidden from their eyes. And I think for us, more often than not, we either intentionally or unintentionally look the other way to those problems we have in our community that we need to deal with. And the reality is that sooner or later we're going to have to do something. We cannot continue to build 500-bed prisons at the rate of $80,000 to $100,000 per bed. I just urge you to take a look at your investment from the viewpoint of the gospel. Within your church, within your communities, there's a lot of people worth salvaging. Amen. Okay, I'd just like to throw it open to any questions you might have at this point, or maybe you're questioned out after the week, I don't know. Might introduce my wife, Margaret, who came up today. I'm very happy to see her here. You've heard me speak to her, most of you anyway. My daughter Connie, you know, I think you all know her. Yes?
Do you know any more about California's thought of putting hemp prisons out in the desert? They've been talking about it.
I haven't heard that one. No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't cost $80,000 a bed, that's for sure. I guess my question is, what will it accomplish? I mean, I don't know anything about it. But I think you missed my point. Those people are going to come back to you. And I think you have to do something for them, unless you want them back the same way you sent them out. I mean, we can't continue to put people, yeah, we can shove them out in the desert. You know, yeah, that's no big deal. We had concentration camps. Hitler had them. We've still got them in areas. And I'm not so sure we haven't got some around our own country. But just to take a group of people, men, women, whatever, and stick them out in the desert, you're really not saving money, because they're going to come back to you sooner or later, one way or another, and it's going to cost you more money. But, you know, I don't understand the rationale for that type of thinking. I really don't, from experience.
And as I say, I don't know, maybe they're thinking about work camps or something of that sort. I have nothing against that. I mean, you know, the old CC camp was pretty neat. We had a lot, this country derived a fantastic amount of benefit from the old CCC. You know, there's opportunity there, I think, to look into, to do something in a humane way. Pay them a certain amount of money. But out of that, of course, take a percentage on a sliding scale for room and board, for restitution, if that's a part of their sentence, for sending home to their family and putting in a fund for their own to be utilized upon their release. I think that has merit. I agree with that. So I really don't know what, but just to shove them out there and forget them.
Yeah, I want to some of the facilities are they have 3 to 4 times more men in there than the same was originally designed for. And of course, it's very, very overcrowded. The idea is that they could put a few of them out there in the tents.
Well, we do that here in this state. Now, the institution that I work in is built for 800. We now have 1,200. Well, we do that to a degree by utilizing our honor camps and work release with those people who show a tendency to be changing their lifestyle and trying to better themselves and move on out. But you only have, you know, you cannot get that group, that many people moving fast enough to offset those coming in. We're bringing in 80 more a month than we're turning loose, see, in this state. So we at the rate, we can't keep up with it. So there's got to be other, yes, ladies.
Well, there's so much that they could do in the way of work to keep their minds and their hands busy and instead of being so sit there in the prison and be penned up and think of it. More aggravated all the time. But going back, we're going to have to change our labor laws, aren't we? Going back to our legislature, I mean, you can't work when you belong to a union or something like that.
Well, I don't think we get so much involved in the changing of the labor laws. I think we might get involved a little bit politically, but we do not have in this state a really good prison industry system whereby these guys could work and do things and help pay the bill, et cetera, et cetera. We do get a lot of static from local businessmen, from the unions in our state. We're a highly unified state. We do have problems with that. They work them as much as they possibly can within the institutions, but it's just like any other, you can only absorb so many men and keep them busy. It's impossible to do.
The lesser ones that have outside work. I mean,
we try that with work release programs and so forth. I think you had.
John, I was going to ask you, is there anything on the drawing board? I don't mean by that, I don't mean building. But from your point of view, is there a way to change these people, reach these people over the long haul before they get into prison? What I'm saying is in the cities, in the towns, as Christians,
I'm not aware of any that. I hear what you're saying. Really, what I think I hear you saying is that, is there any attempt to keep the family unit together? And that's where we are.
You know, it's a big, big, huge problem.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
It seems to me that this is where we should start. That's a long range. It doesn't resolve the immediate, but it certainly will help a lot. But there are programs, I know that there are programs where we as employers, where we can hire people that
are from
the prison and we get credit.
Yeah, right. That I know that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, in the state of Washington, and I think it's pretty prevalent throughout the country, there's real emphasis on exposing abused children and trying to get them either counseling for the family or get the father out of the home or whoever's doing the abusing, whether it's sexual, physical abuse or emotional abuse. I know my wife gets involved in that at times. She's a Mason County Public Health nurse, and she'll probably tell you some stories too. I won't put her on the spot. But and we're getting them in the prison. We're getting all kinds of them in the prison. And for me, that's not going to do them any good. And anybody I've talked to, our psychologists, our psychiatrists, our superintendent, said, hey, you know, we got them, but, and like I said, 98% of them are going to come back.
Are you getting them because there's no other place to put them? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there is no other place to put them. So what we're doing is they're violating the law. You know, they go before the court and they're tried and they're sentenced. It's a felony. I think there's a lot of attempts, like I said the other day, you know, most of our people in prison, a big percentage of them, work hard to get there. They go through the probation situation. They go through the deferred sentencing at times. They get let off with a fine. I mean, they keep coming back, and finally the court gets sick and tired of it and slams them. You know, all this time they're going through all this, there's nothing really done generally to take to counsel, or they are not motivated for more counseling. They don't really think that maybe they're really going to happen to them, and all of a sudden they wind up in prison. I know there's the mental health people, a lot of people referred to mental health for counseling and this type of thing, but here again, the funding and the budgets have been cut so much in the last few years that programs that were available are no longer available to anybody. And granted, there's some, no program is all bad, no program is all good. There's certainly been a need to do some changing, but I think we kind of, maybe it's the only way to do it, I don't know. But anyway, they chop it all off, and those who really need help are not getting it. And I don't know, you know, we had some abusers on the payroll, on the welfare roll, no question about that. And I think that we'll have them from here on out. Like Jesus said, the poor we'll have with us always. But I'm wondering, and this is only a question of my own for me, if we accomplished very much by cutting all the programs off, realizing that we have the abusers, but we sure put a lot of people who were not abusers who need help right down the tube, and some of them wound up in prison. That's a question for myself.
John, you were saying yesterday that it's possible to turn many, 75% instead of these people around and make good citizens out of them. But the cost, our cost as taxpayers is immense. And this is, if they could come up with a way, this is what I'm trying, the overall thing, mm-hmm. to reach these people, to reach the children, the families, before it gets to this point. We could save ourselves so much money and not having to build prisons and not having to have doctors and lawyers and judges try to work with these people to,
Well, this is true. I want to clarify that I didn't say 75% of them can be turned around or will be turned. They have the potential of being turned around. 75% are basically nonviolent offenders who really do not have to be locked up. They could be dealt with in partial incarceration, short-term incarceration, then into a treatment program. Instead of taking these billions of dollars to build a prison, we take that billions of dollars and use it in outpatient counseling treatment centers. I don't know. You know, I don't have all the answers for that by any stretch of the imagination. And I'd venture to say that it would not cost us anywhere near the amount of money that we're paying. The city of, I went to a Charles Colson prayer breakfast here a few months ago, and they quoted the, not the city, but the county, Pierce County, one-third of Pierce County's budget this year is for criminal justice system, one-third of their budget for the whole county, just for the criminal justice system, law enforcement. Fantastic amount of money. Yes?
When there are new people that are in other communities, in other areas, we're talking about more sensible, what's the chances of them becoming so hard to score by going with harder to people? You know, I mean, if they have kind of less chance, serious offenses, and then they're talking about people that have committed really serious offenses,
they do. Yeah, that's one thing I'm saying, that we take a young first offender and throw him in with a lot of other young first offenders and a lot of guys that have been down two or three times, then it's a great school. Boy, they can learn everything. Just then they learn. They use, unless that person has some tools to work with, unless that person is motivated and the people are there to help him be a motivated person, he's probably going to come out just as bad, if not worse, than he went in. And the chances are he'll be worse, because he's going to pick up a lot of stuff, because it's there. Yes?
I'd like to point out some facts and some other things we're talking about, mainly our alternatives that we have. We use most of the things you talked about in the state already.
That's true.
We have probation. We have deferred prosecution for some first-time offenders.
Right.
And that's used extensively, at least in Snohomish County and in King County, where a person, in essence, has to admit guilt to the crime he was committed. He signs a paper. If he violates conditions of his probation, he gets an automatic sentence.
Right.
And isn't it also true less than 1% of all people convicted of felonies wind up in prison?
That's true.
Okay, so that means 99% of what we're trying must be working.
I'm sorry, 99%
what? Doesn't that mean that 99% of what we're trying isn't working? If one out of 100 winds up in prison, 99 others are convicted of a felony or handled some other way.
Either handled some other way or are not prosecuted.
Well, I think they're going on conviction, not those...
Oh, in conviction. Yeah. You may be right. I don't know the figures on that.
Okay.
I don't know the figures on that.
So, some of the things you're talking about then are working.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that nothing in this state is working.
Okay. So then the 1% of the people that we have, as you say, earned it to get there for the most part.
Every one of them. Basically, almost every one of them. There are exceptions, but... By and large, sure, they worked at getting there. I don't disagree with that at all. No. And I'm not saying we don't need our courts. I'm not saying that. What I'm trying to say is that we need to start dealing with these people that we've got in prisons in an effort to rehabilitate those who we can rehabilitate and start somewhere toward getting them, as the gentleman said, before they get even to the courts, if we can do that.
I think the point is we're getting them too late.
Yeah.
Or they're not helping themselves. I think they're having the opportunity to a point, possibly earlier on as delinquents or juveniles, for most of them, they could get better treatment than what they're getting now. Because they really don't get any. They get a probation officer who simply has a case with 150 kids.
Right.
And he can't do anything.
Okay.
Welfare is not plugged into it. It's not coordinated. No. So there is no treatment up until the point where it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did disagree on the part with the 5-year mandatory sentence for a handgun. Number one, I've seen a lot of people who are in prison for that. You can get out 2.5 years. I don't know how they beat them when they get in here, but they're skirting the 5-year mandatory sentence. Also, for the most part, that plea bargain down, very few people get that who actually commit a felony with a handgun. And that's our only viable hand control law right now.
Yeah, the mandatory sentence, I don't know of any that are, that to get around that I've dealt with, let me put it that way, in Shelton, who have beat that after it's once been hung on. I don't know of any cases that have. If it's been there, it's there, and they're doing the time for it.
I've got three cases right now, people I've put in prison who who had handguns, and this was a crime, were convicted of it, and were out there for a year. One of them had 20 years.
Was that dropped?
Pardon?
Was that, what did they, appeal that portion of their sentence and get it dropped? That may be, I don't know.
But the case, I
don't know. I know quite often they'll plea bargain and drop the gun beef.
This is after the trial.
After the court
went to prison with that on it, hanging over them, they come out early.
The judge, they went down with the sentence of a 5-year mandatory. Can't answer that one. I don't know any cases that way, but I'm sure you're probably right, because there's a lot of things go on that, and of course, plea bargaining is fine, except that the parole board sees the whole record and sets the minimum accordingly.
Another thing that I think in all fairness to our country, you mentioned that we have the highest percentage of people in prison per capita in the free Western world.
In the United States, yes.
Yeah.
That's documented.
Really, our population is so much different than Norway or Sweden or England. It's hard to compare us. We are a giant melting pot of all races and creeds and so forth.
Granted.
And we have a lot of problems that are unique to this country alone.
Yeah, I'm not here to, I think maybe you're hearing me point the finger at judges, prosecuting attorneys, United States, whatever. I'm not here to do that, and that's not my point at all. We have a lot of problems in our system that need to be looked at. We have a lot of people that need to be, I think we as citizens and taxpayers have got to look at some other alternatives. And I'm not saying that we don't need what's going on. I don't think long sentences, and I don't know very many people who will agree that long sentences accomplish anything in the punishment of individuals from a treatment standpoint, without any treatment of any kind. I don't know of anybody, at least I've not talked to anybody. Most of the people I talk to, judges, PAs, the whole bit, do not agree. Not necessarily just in this state, but I've been to numerous seminars and so forth that they don't agree that it's...
What about this thinking of the protection of ourselves? I mean, there's X amount of people in there that never get out.
There's what?
There's X amount of people in prison that probably never get out.
Well, about 2% that don't get out.
So instead of thinking of punishment, it's just protection for us.
I'm not sure I follow you. 98% of them are going to get back out in the street anyway. So what I'm trying to say is I think we have to do something so that 98% are not vicious when they get out. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes?
So prisoners wouldn't just come out when they came in. Would it be possible to classify them and then get certain positions in the prison to keep them separate so they don't get involved?
Well, that was, in this state, that was the intent of Shelton, was originally a first-time offender prison. So that, and some years back, you had only first-time offenders there. There were no, if a guy had gone through there and then violated parole and was returned, to the reception center, and he was reclassified then and went to either Monroe or Walla Walla. But now, because of the overcrowding and the amount of people we have, they can't do that anymore. They try to keep the... There's no way of doing it within the institution. They do make every attempt to keep the younger ones down at Shelton, and a lot depends on their age and their crime, where they go. Yes?
You know, scary, straight type program within
the state of Washington? Well, we have a program, something like that, we call Choose Straight. And I dealt some of that yesterday. It's a videotape that it was made by Evergreen State College down in Mason County, Shelton, and they dealt with we used some of our older cons who, there was a movement here some years back to put some of the older cons who were in Walla Walla and Monroe that showed they'd pretty much handled their situation and were a good source or help to some of the younger guys. So they put them down in Shelton, and it's worked pretty well down there. Pretty cool group for a while. And this videotape was made, and we called it Choose Straight. That has a lot of merit, and it's good, but it's only a tool. It has to be followed up with a lot of other things. You can't just take that film out to, or that videotape out to a group or a bunch of high school kids or wherever you're going to show it. And for a while, I mean, it's going to get their attention for a little while, but eventually, and not too long until that kind of wears off. So you've got to follow it up with something else. You can't just use that. Basically, that program, Scared Straight, was considered a failure, but mainly because it was not followed up. Just tried to use it one to twist. Yes?
We have a person, a friend, in a little town of Emmitsburg, Iowa, who teaches in the junior college. Evidently, this is quite prevalent in the state of Iowa. He teaches, auto mechanics. He has about 20 or 25 young people, young boys. The first offense, like they stole a car, a robbery of that type. And we have talked with him, I have anyway, for hours. He's very firm, and he has gotten wonderful results in the school. He is a dedicated man, not having any children himself. And it's just in his glory that he's so happy to him. He says he loses about maybe one more that he cannot turn over. What happens is that they have a big machine shop in the building, they saw them through it. And the farmers bring in their cars, their tractors, whatever they have to meet the table. And he teaches a little boy, a trade. And it's working out really good. There's more than one of the states.
Is that a state funded program?
I think it's yes.
Utilizing. Are they men, young men or young boys that have been sentenced to juvenile facility or first-time offenders? We do the same thing at Shelton. Mm-hmm. We have for vocational training.
Away from any prison at all, they live in a dorm. Mm-hmm. He's a supervisor
We have a machine shop, have an excellent, well-established machine shop, well-equipped machine shop at Shelton. We have auto body and fender, carpentry. All the trades are represented, meat cutting, and these men have the opportunity to enroll in these various groups. The problem is that our facilities aren't large enough to take care of all of them who want to get in, so we can't get them all in length of time.
He says he needs more money. I mean, there it is.
Every program needs more money. Yeah. It's just the same way.
I think the law that you might determine between people who are trained and you also people who are trained in prison, I know Walla, Monroe both have rules, I think they're both of them.
Yeah.
But I have a friend right now, or I know a person who committed a felony at the age of 18, was convicted of an Allen University in jail time. But he now has a degree in electronics. He can't get a job because he has a strong with a lot of companies. He was Packard at one, so that didn't last ever. And if there's a company policy, they don't want to hire somebody who's selling the position. And this is frustrating a lot of people, I'm sure, who don't have a career.
No question about it. I mean, that's where we as a society get up, we say you pay your debt to society and then you're forgiven and, great, come on home. But it doesn't work that way, unfortunately. And there's a lot of guys just in that situation who have really, as I said earlier, we can only be rejected so long, and we're going to say this. Heck with it.
I think one of the problems where there is such high juvenile delinquency is because the school leaving age has to be 18, and kids have to get through high school. I think what would really help is if, as in Europe, in England and Austria, you have an apprenticeship program where kids can leave school at 16 if they don't desire to go to university, and they go into a three-year program, an apprenticeship program, and they earn some money while they're doing it, and yet they have a purpose. And they don't have to go to school if they don't want to. So only the ones that really want to continue their education go to school.
I think that goes on here in the in the state of Washington. Has I know that the trade unions, they have a program where they'll take apprentices and they go through so much schooling and so much on-the-job training type thing, and it takes about, well, depending on the trade, to become a journeyman. But here again, I think it's like so many, it's just not big enough to take care of maybe all I want. Well, I know it isn't big enough to take care of all I want to get. Plus, the unions want to hold it down because of the amount of people.
Yeah, along this line, this idea would be an assumption that the criminal element is not capable of higher learning to an extent. I know you don't really mean that, but there is this, there would be an assumption in this, in thinking of it. And I would say we should go one step further. In my experience in teaching, there are many kids from 14 on 18 who simply should not be in a classroom at school, but there's no place for them. But yet, I doubt society can find this, but they should be allowed to quit school. But they all should be allowed to come back into school very free, without any questions, without any hassle. Go out and say, hey, I want to, this is what happens, really happens. The kid, they want to come back to school, but they can't come back. There's no way for them to re-enter. And because of the lockstep, it was created a lot of social problems. And I think this is going along with her line, extending it maybe further and a little broader. Here's where we should be in our school. We must rearrange our system of how, of the process of education and the laws we have, that all are to be educated equally, therefore they must go at one age in one class, one age in another class. Mm-hmm. These things have to be rearranged, and the European system is very close to that, because the ones who go into vocational also can come back and go to college if they want to pass
the test.
Also,
while they are in the apprenticeship, the choir, they go at least, I believe, a day and a half a week to school. You know, it's just part of the program.
So they're not dead, and then, you know, yeah. You're not talking about even
interesting
dead.
Enough.
No, once they go, they can come back in. So there is this movement, and we're not flexible.
That's true. Interesting enough, we had the state had a training release center at the University of Washington, and we had a number of inmates there who were, instead of going on work release, they were qualified to move out on a work release because of their academic level, because of past schooling or schooling that they had taken within the institution. They were got a chance to go to the training release center at University of Washington, continue on with their education. However, my understanding is that that has gone down the tube because of budget cuts and so forth and so on. I've always said, a lot of years that I go back, that somewhere in our schooling system, we ought to, kids ought to go so far in maybe high school, and then there should be some method of segregating out those who want to go into the trade, who are qualified or have that ability, and those who want to go on to college and so forth. And obviously, we aren't all designed to go to college. So, I, you know, but somewhere along the line, this choice doesn't come out.